Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
We've got a great show for you today. We're going to preview our next books club, which will air next week. And Donnie and I are going to go through some of the headlines before we bring in Pablo, our housing reporter, to discuss a recent article he did with another reporter, Omar, about homeless encampments in Fresno and some of the lingering issues since some of the ordinances were passed. Hopefully everyone listening enjoyed last week's conversation with Henry Gubar, who wrote the book Pave Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. Our next book club will air next Monday, September 30th, and the interview will be with Clayton Aldern, who, along with Greg Colburn, published the book Homelessness is a Housing Problem, How Structural Factors Explain U.S. Patterns. We're going to be interviewing Clayton to get his perspective on many of the homeless ordinances and homeless issues that we're experiencing in Fresno County. We hope he can provide us some perspective from a national scale that can help us better make decisions and alter our perspectives about how to address homelessness in our area. We will be soliciting questions from you related to some of the topics we will be discussing, so make sure you watch the Instagram account or by leaving us an email at tips@fresnoland.org. Donnie, it's been a busy week in the news. What should we know about?
Yeah, it's been a hell of a news week. So Fresno County passed a $5.2 billion budget this week with just less than 2 hours of discussion and no presentations from their budget directors. In Mark Warzowski's Fresno Bee column this week, he quoted Supervisor Buddy Mendez as saying, related to the lack of any budget presentations, "It was all for show. This board, we just get in here, we do our business, and we don't play a lot of games."
Should we be concerned about that?
We should be concerned about that.
I think so, too.
We should be concerned about that.
Yeah, and do we have a sense of the norm in terms of what it looks like typically? Is this usual for these kind of meetings?
I think in the past, the county has had more presentations from budget directors, which is a pretty common thing in local government to do. Yeah. It's what the city council does, the Fresno City Council. They have typically a whole week of just hearings, and it's meant to provide the public with a detailed deep dive of what exactly every department is spending on, what the changes are from the last year. And to Buddy's comment, that's not helpful or necessary because we already know all of this information. The hearings aren't for you, supervisors. They're for the public.
Mm-hmm. Transparency and accountability is important for public trust and civic institutions.
Correct. Yes. And then in a continuation over the saga over a petition to annex 600 acres of land from Sierra Unified School District into Clovis Unified, and this is land next to Millerton Lake, Juliana Morano from Fresnoland reported on a hearing this week where an obscure Fresno County committee heard more testimony from Sierra Unified residents about that decision. One realtor who was at this meeting, whose children attend Sierra Unified schools, said the district is a selling point for her, and if people don't want to send their kids to Sierra schools, they can sell their home and move to Clovis. The county now has, this new county committee has about 120 days to vote on this petition.
I really appreciated that comment. I thought it perfectly captured just the reality of the situation, which is, are we going to dramatically alter district maps? Or for a small group of people, and what kind of precedent does that set for the valley? That I can't be good.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. In related news, a prominent Fresno family, the Assemis, who are involved in the prayer petition that we just talked about, they own about 50,000 acres of pistachios and almonds across the Central Valley. They're also major suburban developers. They own Granville Homes, media company GV Wire. They are facing lawsuits for not just one, but two of their lenders this week, Prudential Assurance and U.S. Bank, for defaulting on over $700 million of loans for their farming operation. This isn't the first sign of financial trouble for mega farmers with pistachio and almonds. We had bankruptcies from Primo Wawona and Trinitas Farming in the last year, but this is the first for the Assembly family. And while they haven't filed for bankruptcy, defaulting on $700 million of loans is not a good sign. And then finally, Rob Parsons, our editor at Fresnoland, reported this week that the city of Clovis is facing a lawsuit threat from a Malibu attorney over what he alleges is a violation of California's Voter Rights Act, because in Clovis, they don't elect city council members by district. The city council members represent the entire city. And the attorney in Malibu is saying that the Latino vote in Clovis, which Latinos are about 35% of the population in Clovis, is being diluted because they don't have district representation. Clovis is one of the larger cities in California to still have council members be elected citywide instead of by districts. But Clovis Unified last year went to district-based elections, so it's the writing is on the wall, according to
some coming.
People.
It's coming. Does this Malibu attorney have any connection to Fresno or Clovis?
No, they've made a career out of suing cities and counties over Voter Rights Act allegations, and they have yet to lose a lawsuit.
Doesn't bode well.
No. Today, we are joined by Fresno Land's housing reporter, Pablo Orihuela, to talk with us about a story that he recently reported with Omar Rashad, also with Fresno Land. Pablo, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Pablo, you've been in the weeds on the Grants Pass decision from the Supreme Court. So many twists and turns in the last 4 to 6 weeks. And then you and Omar came out this last week with this story that really goes into how the homeless community, unhoused residents are preparing for supposedly the loss of their ability to have encampments. And tell me a little bit, how did you guys decide to report this story in the first place?
Yeah, so some form of early stage embryonic version of the story has been pie in the sky for me for a while. I think being the housing reporter, you and Rob could probably attest to the fact that every city or county meeting, or especially now once these ordinances were introduced and there were hearings over them, just a ton of claims get made on. There are people that will say that there is housing and shelter in abundance here, as well as comprehensive, robust supportive services available and offered to people sleeping in Fresno's homeless encampments, and that they simply refuse to accept them. There are darker narratives around the fact that these people living in encampments right now are all suffering and living with some sort of alcohol and drug addiction or a mental health concern. And on the other side, there are people claiming that there are no services available, or that there's some sort of mistreatment going on between the workers that come out and come to clear these encampments. Again, ultimately, a lot of them are anecdotal. So Omar initially had the idea, once the first couple of ordinances started kicking in and it looked like it was going to get approved at the city and county level, that we should probably start looking at encampment sweeps. And so eventually we talked about it together as a newsroom, and we came up with the idea to just all put some feelers out to people we know that are currently living on the streets, attorneys that defend people who go through evictions, local housing advocates, letting them know, hey, we understand that these ordinances are about to kick in and you probably had a lot going through your mind right now, but we would like to get a very fly on the wall observation about how these clearances take place in the first place. We really want to see what actually happens before and after the ordinance takes place, especially. And so eventually we got our first message. I want to say it was Thursday, August 29th. That the encampment that we wrote about was going to be cleared on Wednesday, September 4th. So within those 5 days, we had to figure out how we're going to report it, how we need to introduce ourselves, where are we going to go, is this public property, private property? There were so many logistics I had to go through, but ultimately we decided that we shouldn't be very, there's a time to be judicious about where to go and cover these things, but ultimately, you know,
things were happening fast, so you had to move
absolutely
fast.
Yeah.
And you landed on an encampment that's on railroad property, and it's in like central Fresno. Tell us a little bit about the neighborhood where this encampment is.
Yeah, people could see we have a nice little graphic in the story to help illustrate it, but it is on the west side of the intersection of North Clark and East Floridora Avenue, and to the west of, I want to say it's North Clark, there is immediately the Dry Creek Canal. And then after that, just a big kind of dirt plot of land neighboring the railroad tracks, and that is where the encampment takes place. And to the east of Clark, I mean, it's less than a stone's throw away. It begins like just a small little quaint residential neighborhood of single-family homes. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting that we were able to get all these interviews with all these people living at the encampment, living at the houses, at the city level, at the supportive service level, asking how this kind of community, for lack of a better word, coexists and the issues that come with that.
And how many people, when you guys first went out there, how many people roughly live at that encampment?
Gosh.
Because there's probably a lot of people coming and going, I imagine. So
absolutely.
It's transitional.
Even the day of the encampment clearing, there was a ton of people moving in and out. But when we first arrived, I want to say that was Wednesday the 3rd. I would say there were about a dozen tents, and each tent had about 3 or 4 people coming and going. So, gosh, you do the math on that. I would say at least 2 dozen people.
Okay. How heterogeneous is like their perspective when you're interviewing them? Is there kind of common themes that come through a lot of the interviews and conversations you have, or is there a lot of different perspectives within the encampment?
Oh, there's different perspectives. And what was interesting for us to see is that the debate I'm sure you guys and we have every day about whether the ordinances will be effective or not, what the solutions to homelessness are, the people living in these encampments are having the same ones. So it was a bit interesting to see that they really, a lot of them invited us to help get their input in and give them a platform to give us a better understanding of why they're there and how they ended up there and the struggles they have with trying to get out.
And I thought it was interesting you guys asked them this question of how to solve homelessness and do you think it can be solved, and share a little bit about their answers. I thought they were pretty interesting.
Yeah, so in the article, one of the people we got the most time with was a man named Rabbit, and he mentioned that much like we hear at all these city and county meetings, that homelessness seems to be a bit of a spectrum. There are people that are struggling with mental health disorders or some sort of addiction that makes it hard for them to really have agency the way you and I would when we need help for any supportive service. And that in the mind of Rabbit, there are also people who are choosing to live this way. And for whatever reason, that's been their decision. And ultimately, how the county or city chooses to help these people was ultimately going to be up to them. But they themselves wonder, I'm not going to kick out this person who can't help themselves, because they're all in the same boat, right?
Yeah.
So one thing, Pablo, that I thought was interesting in the story is you talked to some homeowners who live in the area, and they obviously had some feelings about the encampment. Tell us a little bit about, so how did you find the homeowners, and what did you learn from their perspective in talking with them?
Yeah, so we talked to the Ralston family. They're a couple that live neighboring the encampment on the east side of Clark. And without giving their address away, seriously, less than a stone's throw away, that is their house, the street, the canal, and then where the encampments begin. And we just saw them doing the same thing we were doing the day of the encampment clearing. They were on their front yard just seeing what was going on. And then we flagged them and said, hey, we're reporters here at Fresnoland. We're reporting on encampment clearings. We'd love to get your perspective if you have one to share. And that's where we learned a couple things, like the fact that this encampment site has been popping up for at least five, I think now six times. That sometimes there are some relatively nice neighbors and sometimes there are not, as we found out on the second interview with them. And Elaine, who's one of the people living there, she has a respirator on. And one of the issues she struggles with is the fact that the encampment can sometimes have fires going on. And she has a bit more of a reserved take, mm-hmm. at least at the beginning when we started talking to her, but she has a very real medical issue that is affected by these fires. And eventually that will help shade her opinion on how she feels about encampments. And then for better or for worse, the homeless community at Fresno at large.
And the quote that you used in the headline of the story is from Rabbit, "Where the hell can we go?" And he had this quote in the story that's, we always have this question, but now even more than ever, it's this question of where we go. And you noted in the story from Zach Dara, who runs the Pavarello House, who runs almost 300 shelter beds in town, that they're almost at 99% capacity in the shelters. And so there is this question of literally, where do people go? And where do you feel like in the conversations you were having with unhoused residents, like what they would like to see as a result?
Yeah, because we need to use a design thinking approach, right? And it's hard when you're creating government policy. It can't be one-to-one, but meeting people's needs where they are. And we can talk about the different kinds of beds that exist and what maybe Fresno needs or what the majority of our unhoused people might need. But yeah, I'd be curious their perspective on what they feel, like meeting our users where they are, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Omar talked to Dara, and what we found was that there was truth on both sides. Yes, there are no homeless people, it seems like, going to particularly Pavarello House shelter beds, but that is because they are at capacity. And really, the 99% might as well be rounded up to 100, if only because shelters like Pavarello tend to have some aside, particularly if there are any domestic violence victims that might need a bed instantly, or youth or single mothers. So really, they're just one of the many shelter houses here in the city and the county level that are at capacity. Mm-hmm. And given the most recent Fresno Madera Continuum of Care point in time counts, we know that there are over 1,000, nearing 2,000 homeless people as of, and that is as recent as 2023. And has the city done a good job in raising the amount of shelter beds available? Yeah, absolutely. We're now over 800. The number of homeless people living outside still eclipses that number. And so it's a question of, if all the people take services and there still aren't enough for everyone to go around, who does the buck get passed along to?
Yeah. And one of the other residents in the story, Ty, talked about that there are some barriers beyond shelters before people become homeless for people to find housing. And a lot of people in the streets have a criminal background and they can't pass a background check, or they have an eviction on the record and so they can't get in. And so just showing some of the systemic barriers a lot of people are having to getting into housing and how real that is. Do you have any conclusions with the residents that you talked to? What would they like to see?
Oh gosh, more shelter availability would definitely help. We even got that quote from Dara from the Poverello House that there is clearly a need. There's the number of people currently living out in public outweighs the amount of beds available. So who would increase that count, whether it's the city or county, that's a different discussion, but an increased bed count might help. Housing advocates would turn around and say that there needs to be more renters protections. It could be anybody listening to this podcast with misses a paycheck or two, and they could be in dire straits as well. The solutions to it, goodness gracious, the city and county would probably turn around and say there will be these ordinances that are a solution to it. And I guess only time will tell if it really is or not. But it was just nice to get the perspective of all these people and know that the issue is much more complex than I think people on either side of the aisle paint it to be.
And what's been the response? I know we talked offline and you had said that, so the story published on a Friday and throughout the weekend, you just kept getting email after email of comments. And what are people telling you about the story?
Yeah, so the feedback in general has been really varied and, quite frankly, like in the most positive, endearing way, a bit overwhelming. For those who don't know, at the end of all of our articles at the Fresno website, in lieu of a comment section, which we provide through social media, we have a little box at the end that asks readers, did the story have an impact on you? And if so, please tell us how. In case anybody was wondering, yes, we do see those. We do read those. We like taking into account the opinions and perspectives of our readers. And I don't think I've ever had, or actually I know I never had, as many responses to an article than with this one. It hasn't really stopped since, actually, still. And we're over a week since it's published. Particularly that first weekend when we published it, I believe it was on Friday the 13th, I would get a little notification through email, I would say every hour on the hour.
What's the broad thrust of the comments you're receiving?
And they're really varied, right? You know, there are some people that read this article and they pull whatever quote they want as confirmation bias, right? Mm-hmm. They'll see Rabbit's quote about how certain people are choosing to live on a street because they refuse to give up drugs or refuse to get a job. And they'll say, oh, see, this is exactly what I'm talking about. And they use that quote to paint all the brush. I would say maybe ignoring the quote that comes right after that, saying that they judge all of us by the opinions or the actions of a few. And there are some people that use this article and say this is great reporting and it's the perfect kind of confirmation bias they need to advocate for more housing, for more supportive services to be integrated. And then there are people obviously in the middle who are somewhat ambivalent and just be like, hey, or we'll just say, hey, this is a great article. This made you feel upset. I'd love to know how I could get more active in the conversation surrounding solutions for these people.
It is amazing how it's such a Rorschach test for ourselves. And when we actually dig into the numbers nationally, in terms of at a national scale, the homeless population is less than a fifth of 1%. Mm-hmm. To put that in perspective, if we look at people living below the poverty line, you would probably have to add an exponent to it. But we spend a lot of time on this subject because I think it hits a certain chord for people. Why do you think that is, Donnie?
Yeah, I think homelessness is such a visible problem in a lot of cities across the U.S. And to respond to it demands that we ask ourselves some really hard questions about what we believe and what our values are. Mm-hmm. Do we believe that everyone deserves a place to live? Not everyone believes that, and this debate brings that out in a lot of people. Do we believe that people who have found themselves in addiction deserve the same things as a single mom who has scraped her way from the bottom of the barrel to the top? And I think because it elicits those really difficult philosophical questions, I think it has demanded a lot of our attention and resources. And I think there's something visceral about seeing someone living on the streets that we know as just human beings that shouldn't be acceptable. And I have kids, and when we drive around town and we see a person who is living on the streets, my kids, my five-year-old, ask questions about it, has a lot of, it's compelling. So it's like, it's a natural reaction, I think, for us as humans to want to figure out how to fix it.
Yeah, I think the visibility thing is the other thing. And the other thing I was thinking about when I was reading the story was about beds, you know, and how complicated beds are.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of different types of beds, emergency shelter beds, which are temporary, like Pablo was talking about, like,
right.
You know, if you lose your housing or lose your job, you can stay there while you figure out what's next. And then you have transitional housing, which mm-hmm. transitional housing is complicated because you need wraparound services.
Right.
And then you have permanent supportive housing. So if you've got mental health problems, you might need to stay there for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And those are really expensive for cities to build, not only upfront costs, but the costs of maintaining those facilities. And so then we're taking this issue, which affects a small percentage of the population, it's becoming big in terms of the budget of what it costs to maintain those services. And so I think people are asking, like, you know, that leads some people to say, why can't they just figure it out or something, that kind of pull yourself up. Mm-hmm. But I also think that you have to understand the problem and understand what the appropriate solution is for the problem.
And it's, and we'll go into this, I know, on a future podcast, but it's so multifaceted in that there's the beds issue, which is meant to solve the problem of people who are already homeless. Mm-hmm. There are upstream policy solutions that have been debated in the past around rent control.
Like affordable housing, like affordable we talk about housing on this podcast all the time.
Right, exactly. And though it's all related, and when we talk to policymakers about this, we're always trying to push them, what are your solutions beyond a ban? And they're like, we don't have that many. And we're like, we need to have more, and we need to address upstream issues. And I think it's hard because it goes back to this question of who deserves and in our society. And I think it's a hard one for a lot of people.
Where do we go from here, Pablo?
Gosh, I'm not sure. Yeah, I just want to go back to something that was said earlier. I think people on both sides of the aisle arguing for some sort of adequacy or what have you. I think everyone agreed that, you know, the presence of these encampments, of these people living out in public spaces, is something that cannot stand. But who's responsible for helping clear those out? That's where I think where a lot of the debate begins. Is it a local government's responsibility to provide these supportive services and housing? Is it up to these people living on a street to pick themselves up by their bootstrap and find a job or maybe move to somewhere else where the cost of living might be lower? And that's where I think the debate begins. We have as early as last month where we have the mayor at a local event saying that housing is a fundamental right. And we have, I'd imagine, more city meetings happening very soon on follow-ups to this ordinance, whether they be amendments or public feedback that I'm sure will not go away with every local government meeting. But yeah, as to where we go from here, I wish I had an answer. I'm sure we'll find some answers in any future reporting I have, but it's a very complicated issue. And I really just hope that if people take away one thing from reading the article that Omar and I wrote, where we worked so hard on it, is that it's just that the issue is very complicated. And that I think regardless of where you stand on the aisle of how to solve the homeless issues here in Fresno, that people understand that there is a lot of nuance involved that maybe they hadn't taken into account before.
We're going to close today with our favorite segment, which is what we're loving this week. We're going to start with Donnie. We haven't heard from her in a while. What are you loving this week?
It's fall. Actually, it's fake fall, but I'll take fake fall as a beginning to fall. And so I'm like, as a millennial white girl who loves fall, you go to Trader Joe's, you get all the pumpkin things, you get the pumpkin spice. I have yet to do my pumpkin spice latte from Starbucks.
Did they start selling that stuff in August?
They do.
Oh my God.
It's a violation. Oh my God. Should happen after Labor Day, but I
digress. Yes, okay.
All the fall stuff, and then football. I love.
It's true.
And I have a fantasy football team this year, and my team's name is Moody's Mama, named after Jake Moody of the San Francisco 49ers.
That's a good name.
It is a good name. My son and I, we share a team together. He was more active in the recruitment than I was. We're 2-0.
So he's the drafter. Are you the team manager now? You manage?
Yes.
Okay, the waiver wire?
Yes.
He's the GM and you're the owner.
Yes.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I do have to share my fantasy football team name because I'm very proud of it. It's Cup My Life Into Breezes, which is a line from a song you might know because I have Cooper Kupp on my team.
Okay.
But anyway, let's continue. How's your team doing?
So we're 2-0, and I have to say, so we named ourselves Moody's Mama because Jake Moody was like the clincher for our team in the first week. Because did you watch the Monday Night Football game?
Of course I watched the Monday Night
Football game. Okay, it was incredible. And we had like a 1% chance, our fantasy team, of winning against my father-in-law, who we were playing against, his team. And my husband was like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, you guys are going to lose a 1% chance. There's no way. Jake Moody would have to have a historic game in order for you to win. And I'm like, what does that mean? And he's like, yeah, he's going to have at least 6 field goals. And I was like, we're going to do it. And then he did it. And we won. by
that's
one.
That's right. He had so many field goals that game.
Yeah.
That's bold to name your team after a kicker. Kickers are often relegated to the periphery of fantasy football teams.
Sure.
They're like something you have to have, but you don't think about a lot. Prioritize the kicker. I just love
that. You see how the Chargers like to get really into Dicker the kicker? Like,
yes.
I like that. I'm into that energy.
For a few reasons. All right, Pablo, what are you loving this week?
Gosh, if we're going to stay on the world of sports, I guess maybe you could talk about like real football and the real teams. And like my favorite team, just full transparency, is the Seattle Seahawks.
Which is an unfavorable thing to prefer in a Niner-focused city.
But I'll give you the uniforms are good.
Yeah. Colors are fine.
You know, 2-0, it's nice to be undefeated.
Better record than the Niners right now.
Yeah,
that's
true.
A good thing. Yeah. True.
We'll hope it stays that way throughout the season. But. Yeah. And
do you like your new coach? You got a new coach this year. It's been Pete Carroll for, I don't know, as long as I can remember.
The coach is undefeated throughout his entire career as a head coach. We'll take that. And just keeping with the fall trend, I'm loving the ability to now introduce some more layers into my outfit. I love a button-up as much as anyone else here, but it's nice to be able to break out the trench coat, a long sleeve.
Yep, I am wearing flannel right now. And it's probably a little too soon, like Donnie getting pumpkin stuff too soon, but I'm rolling it out, even though I have some minor back sweat. What I'm loving this week is a newish coffee cart. So for those of you who are familiar with kind of the Shepherd and Willow area where Enzo's table used to be, that's been moved across the street. And I will periodically go to there on Saturdays because there's a coffee cart that's posted up in there called Knockbox. It's a really cool kind of setup. He does traditional kind of coffee drinks like your cortados, your lattes, your flat whites. But he also has these amazing, I don't know, they're like juice drinks almost. And he has this one called Love that I always get for my wife. And it's guava juice and like vanilla cream and like lemon zest on top. It's not coffee related in any way, but it is incredible. And if I come through the door with that, I'm winning for that.
That
weekend.
Sounds so good, but Shepherd and Willow is like
that's a hike. It's a hike.
Basically the Bermuda Triangle from my perspective.
I would say it's worth the journey.
Okay. Good
yes,
to know.
It's a pilgrimage for sure. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.